You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Now I think I know.
It's the deep time.
We need not just a transition, we need a transformation. It has to be extremely rapid. And especially here in the United Kingdom, we have a real interest in accelerating socio-technical transitions, which sounds very grand. The question to always ask is, well, who's going to do it?
Anyone with a brain feels uneasy about the Australian bushfires right now. They look too much like a photograph of our developing future. Even during the death and destruction, Australian TV and newspapers air voices denying climate change has anything to do with the fires, long-term drought, or even the continuing punishing heat. Mark Hudson studied the whole operation of anti-climate activities in Australia. His doctoral thesis is titled Staying Power, Incumbent Strategies to Defeat Carbon Pricing in Australia, 1989 to 2011. Mark is now working in the UK at the University of Kiel, and he is affiliated with the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. From the Midlands, Dr. Mark Hudson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, great to be with you.
I would like to spend time chatting with you, asking why a nice Australian like yourself has been transplanted to academia in the UK, but really our time together is too short for that, and this Australian fire catastrophe has left me speechless. Mark, how are you feeling about the heat and fires in your home country at this time?
It's left me sleepless, and I'm not alone. I'm a suburban boy. Most Australians live in towns or cities. We like to imagine that we're Crocodile Dundee, but most people are city folk. And so I don't claim any particular kinship with small towns that have been burnt to the ground. But I've holidayed in those places. I have friends and acquaintances from those places. And if you're a human being, you just look at that and you think of the death and the destruction for human beings, but also all those species and the functional extinction for a lot of them. And you ask me how I feel angry, devastated, all the usual cliches. But there's a lot of anger because this, as I said in one of the articles that I've had published, this is not a tragedy, because a tragedy is kind of inevitable. And what we're seeing now is part of the consequences of deliberately not taking action 30 years ago, before many of your listeners will have even been born. We were warned, and in Australia we were warned early and well by very good scientists, one of whom I've interviewed for my PhD. And you couldn't have asked for better science and better scientists. And what is happening now is because the Australian state and Australian corporate interests were very successful in stopping any meaningful action on climate change.
You did a deep dive into fossil fuel lobby groups in Australia. Did you find links between climate denial institutions in Australia and in America?
Yes, but there are two caveats that I would make, or one major caveat, which is that by about 1994, there had been a conscious decision within the higher reaches of the big mining companies not to use climate denial themselves, because it would cost them credibility, and because at one point it would have cost them access to the senior decision makers. That is not to say that there are not links. So there is a book by an Australian academic called Dominic Kelly. He and I have been in touch, where he explored these more deeply. Then you have a company in Australia that got bought out by BHP, but was very active in the 70s, 80s, and well into the 90s, called Western Mining Company. And its CEO was a chap called Hugh Morgan, who is still alive, who is kind of the archetypal climate denier. And he had an offsider, a chap called Ray Evans. And you can, and they weren't particularly secret about this. Ray Evans attended the United States meetings of groups like the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation. And so there is interplay, and then various speakers like Pat Michaels. But they were present in Australia, especially in the early 90s, and then again in the mid-late 2000s. It's kind of more an arm's-length relationship. So, for example, in Australia, there's a right-wing think, or a libertarian, it wants to call itself, think tank, called the Institute for Public Affairs. And they're very secretive about their funding. They used to get more funding from fossil fuel companies, but the fossil fuel companies stopped doing that, not so much because of the climate denial, but because of the attitude towards Indigenous affairs. There are climate deniers in Australia. They are funded by international and capitalist interests. The Heartland Institute, that your listeners may know from the United States, that was involved in various conferences in 2010, 11, 12 in Australia, which were particularly hot years for climate change and climate change denial. But a direct link where the elite CEOs are sitting down and saying, how are we going to stop climate policy from happening? I know, let's give money to this climate denial organization and that will work. That's not what happened in Australia. It was a lot more sophisticated and cunning and ultimately effective.
So the current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was previously Managing Director of Tourism Australia.
And he was.
Yes, and tourism is now bigger financially and employs far more people in Australia than coal. Does Scott Morrison and the people he represents really believe tourists are going to come for the vast burned-out landscape, the annual smoke clouds, or the dead coral reefs? I mean, it's nuts.
You'd have to ask him, but maybe we'll have a Mad Max amusement park the size of a continent. I don't know. A couple of things. You point to the gap between sort of tourism as an employer, tourism jobs, and the mining jobs. And I wrote an article about 3 years ago called Wind Beneath Their Contempt, How Australian Policymakers, Why Australian Policymakers Hate Wind and Solar. And one of the points I made is that there's a masculinity thing going on. So jobs in mining are men's jobs. Jobs in tourism, where you're a waiter or a tour guide or a scuba instructor, they're kind of effeminate. And so there's a cultural dimension. The other thing that I'd say is that there's a wonderful PhD thesis, which is, now there's not words you don't hear often, which is actually freely available on the internet. And it was written by a chap who asked exactly the kind of question you're asking. How come all the other sectors which were going to be affected by climate change, whether it was the insurance industry or banking or agriculture or tourism, how come when it mattered, they were so silent on the issue of climate policy? And so what this guy did, his name is Guy Pearce, not the actor, but a different Guy Pearce, is he was able to interview lobbyists from all the different trade associations, the Tourism Board of Australia or whatever it was called at the time. This is before Scott Morrison turned up on the scene. And ultimately, he wrote a PhD thesis about business power and Australia, where he concluded that the mining industry had been able to effectively elbow everyone else out to get a complete monopoly on the ears of ministers and to convince the policymakers that mining jobs were it, mining jobs were the future. And as I said, it's a wonderful PhD. It caused a bit of a stink in Australia back in 2006-07. It's sort of considered as, or it was the first book that talked about the so-called greenhouse mafia hypothesis, which I've just laid out. As for what Scott Morrison believes, I think one of the things that hasn't been mentioned quite so much, and I can understand why it hasn't, is that Scott Morrison is a Pentecostalist. Now, I have no problem with what people believe. They can believe what they like. But one of the interesting things about Pentecostalism is that unlike many other strands of Christianity, it doesn't have a stewardship strand. And no one's been able to get Scott Morrison to actually say what he believes about the rapture and what's going to happen on planet Earth? And I think that that question might be worth asking if a journalist was able to get him to give a straight answer.
Well, you know, I learned from you that Scott Morrison took his infamous lump of coal to the Australian Parliament during an incredible heat wave there, right during the heat wave. So I then realized, well, maybe we should expect to see the most vulgar denial exactly when climate tragedies strike. That's when the big boys, fear the public might wake up.
It's also, I think, if you scratch the surface, they at least some of these people are not stupid. I mean, I wouldn't say that every Australian parliamentarian is an Einstein in waiting, but then I wouldn't say that of the UK Parliament either, or Manchester, where I'm from. But, yeah, look, when reality is breaking through, that's when you tend to double down on your denial. And we know that from people who are, you know, about to die of alcoholism or whatever. It's when the consequences are really piling up that you become most vehement in saying something is not happening. That lump of coal that he waved around in Parliament, he'd been given to him by the Peak Mining Body, the Minerals Council of Australia, and they had lacquered it so it wouldn't smudge on his hands. And he waved it around as the electricity grid in New South Wales was basically buckling under the pressure. Because, of course, when there's a heat wave, people switch on their air conditioning and demand goes through the roof. And then the coal-fired power stations, which are pretty old, can't cope.
Radio EcoShock.
With Climate Australia still kind of driving around without seatbelts, the country had that crude seatbelt in their carbon pricing, but even that was thrown out, apparently, to please the coal lobby. You studied that history of white Australia's guarding the bastion of coal and along with a coal workers' union. Is there a lesson there for all of us, though, Mark Hudson?
Oof, there are many lessons from the way that climate policy has been made in Australia, all of them object lessons, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other. First, I'd like to say that we sometimes get fixated on carbon pricing as, you know, a viable solution, and I'd say two things. One is carbon pricing, if it had been implemented in the late 1980s, early 1990s, could have been a big part of fixing things. I'm not ideologically opposed to markets in certain circumstances. I would argue that there are always issues around markets and that a carbon tax, a different form of pricing, would have been preferable, not because it's more economically efficient, but because it's easier to explain. But because we've left it so late, carbon pricing, whether it's a tax or an emissions trading scheme, becomes less significant. You're going to need much bigger amounts of state intervention, economic dislocation, and you're going to need a ton of luck because we haven't done anything for the last 30 years. So having said that, coming back to the question around carbon pricing and how it was demolished in Australia, there are a series of what-ifs and if-buts and so forth. I think what, if I were to sum it up in a nutshell, happened, or the lesson is, it's quite easy for however you want to determine, call it, you know, right-wing or big business or incumbent forces who are interested in preserving the status quo to throw enough mud that eventually some of it sticks. And between sort of 2008 and 2012-13, there was an enormous effort to paint climate change as something that only inner city, pointy-headed, latte-sipping, effete intellectuals believed in, and that it was probably a hoax, and that if any action were taken on climate change, it would destroy the Australian economy virtually overnight. I know I sound like I'm exaggerating, but you know I can go back and find you statements that were not that different. So there was one town that had a steel mill, and according to Tony Abbott, who became Prime Minister and repealed the climate pricing legislation, it would be wiped off the map. And of course, the carbon price came in, and Whyalla was not wiped off the map. So the lesson is, and I suppose it's one that we're learning even more now with fake news and bots on the internet that can pretend to be trusted sources but are actually sort of crowding out the truth, is that the public is, if enough money is thrown at it, the public might get confused about what policies are in the best interests of all citizens versus what are in the interest of the rich people who are benefiting from the status quo, who would like to keep benefiting from the status quo. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mark Hudson. He's currently in Manchester, a transplanted Australian, and we're talking about the fires in Australia and a burning world. Do you think, Mark, that white people assume that only white people can solve the climate crisis? And by white people, I probably just mean white men.
If you're asking me if Australia is a racist, sexist hellhole, hell yeah. look, your listeners are in Canada, and I probably don't need to explain to your listeners what a settler colony is.
We have listeners in Australia. You're talking to Australia right now, my friend.
Yeah, I grew up when the White Australia policy, the clue is in the name, had only been abolished sort of officially, I think a year or two after I was born. And I grew up in a city, Adelaide, which is still pretty white, but when I was growing up, it was astonishingly white. And the article that I mentioned earlier, Wind Beneath Their Contempt, kind of touches on this without being explicit enough about the particular history of Australia as a settler colony. But very quickly, if you think back to the 1950s, we thought we'd have holidays on the moon, electricity too cheap to meter, and that essentially white, technologically minded, heterosexual men would dominate nature and control everything. And then in the space of sort of 15 years, between about 1960 and 1975, you have the Black Civil Rights Movement, you have second wave feminism, you have gay rights, and you also have the ecology movement coming onto the scene. And then in that 15-year period, the dream of total control by white heterosexual men over nature is just destroyed. And we're still kind of living with the psychological consequences of that. And that's around the world. And if you throw in settler colonialism on top of that, you get a very potent mix. And so this sort of willful denial of limits and this idea that somehow we are always going to be able to conquer and deal with the consequences of our previous environmental actions that have impinged on the environment. It's very strong, and it's very hard to let go of because it's quite terrifying to realize that we're on a fragile planet and we've done it a lot of damage. And I think that's what's coming through with the fires where you started the conversation. A lot of people are looking at that and going, oh, bugger. This is out of our control. And when people are out of control, they get very scared.
Now, your research shows how industry weathers short-term public demand for climate action and then returns the whole system to the normal or worse every time. If climate activists understand that mechanism, could that help them somehow overcome the industry's strong defensive game?
If you're asking me whether activists should learn from history and sociology, yes, they should. I spend a lot of my time thinking about this, talking about this, and writing about this. It's one of the motivations for writing for this website, The Conversation. I don't get paid a penny. And just today, I saw that one of the articles I wrote has been republished by a major private media conglomerate, and I still don't get a penny. I don't mind that. I knew those were the rules of the game when I came into it. But I just want to say that, yes, as an academic, or as an activist, and now as an academic, I have always felt that there was a hell of a lot to learn from Indigenous peoples and their struggles, because they have been on the pointy end of what we're doing for a long time, and from our own histories. And those histories tend to get forgotten. So waves of concern about the environment and climate specifically have traditionally lasted 2 or 3 or 4 years. And as you say, the big companies have learned how to concede a little ground, most of which they're going to be able to reclaim a year or 2 or 3 later when nobody is watching. A policy can be watered down and eventually binned. And you see it on a local level in my city where I live now, Manchester. In terms of the dangers for especially Australian climate activists, I've written a paper which I've submitted to a journal or comment piece, and I'll give you a précis. I think over the next 10 years, you might actually see a decarbonisation of the Australian energy and transport systems, or a much quicker decarbonisation than we're currently anticipating, because these fires will motivate and galvanise, and with the right combinations of sort of political skill and cultural skill, you could see coalitions emerging where rooftop solar becomes even more important and battery storage kicks off and the transport system becomes electrified. So it may be that in 10 years' time, Australia, instead of being horrifically high in its per capita carbon footprint, is actually at the lower end of the international, or of the rich countries. That's not impossible. It may not happen, but that's not impossible. What I think is very, very unlikely is that Australia will stop exporting fossil fuels. The infrastructure there is there for coal and for liquefied natural gas. It is that infrastructure has been assiduously built over the last 50 years, and lots of public money has been spent on it. I think the only thing that will stop Australia exporting that is good old-fashioned market forces if the customers on the other end don't need it or don't want it. But the domestic possibilities for an effective resistance to Australia's export of fossil fuels, I hope I'm wrong. I wish I were wrong, but I just don't see it happening.
I think it's going to drive a geopolitical change in that part of Asia and the Southern Hemisphere, where there will be pressure from Europe and hopefully North America, possibly even sanctions for people who produce coal and natural gas.
Oh, they've been talking about that for a long time. And yes, maybe you're right. I hope you're right. I struggle to see the North Americans, either the Canadians or the United States, instituting sanctions on fossil fuel exports, especially since America has been benefiting from the fracking boom. And the Canadians and their tar sands, I hope you're right. Europeans, maybe. Japanese, maybe. Chinese, less likely.
Although the Japanese have been a big buyer for Australian coal. But the one that really worries me is India. I think India is planning out their coal future on Australian coal.
There's reasons for hope there in the terms of the price of solar power in India is dropping precipitously, and there are big movements afoot within various Indian states. And I should preface what I'm saying with, I am not an expert on India. But, you know, when you burn coal, there are enormous local air quality issues, especially regardless of what kind of coal you burn, and Australian coal is supposed to be, well, is, quote, more clean or more pure. But nonetheless, you always have big air quality issues, and it's not clear to me that India will continue with its appetite for coal that seemed a few years ago to be insatiable. That may not be the case.
Now, you talk about recurring windows for climate action, but my recent guest on the radio show, Dr. Nate Hagen, suggests that we're not going to do anything about climate change because we are also completely invested on it and dependent on it, even for our food system. So he doesn't see any action coming until a big, big crash of the system, possibly a financial crash. What do you think?
I think he's quite probably right. In terms of waves of public, I suppose what you'd need to do is distinguish between waves of public attention on an issue and actual policy that bites deep and changes the system. So the very quick history, and I mean, this is crude, would look like first wave of environmental concern from about 69 to 72, 73, or overpopulation. Malthus, as the famous book by Third Time Lucky movie with Charlton Heston, he plays a cop, overpopulation. Soylent Green. Got there in the end. Soylent Green.
Oh, Soylent Green.
And then that kind of gets resolved because you have the big international conference in Sweden, and then the oil shock hits at the end of 73, and everyone forgets about the birds and the bees being drowned out or whatever, and is more concerned about standard of living issues. Then from the mid-80s to about 92, you have Amazon rainforest, ozone, and climate change. And that kind of dies down because the Americans win the Cold War, and there's the Rio Earth Summit. So people kind of think, well, there's now a bureaucracy in place. There's an agreement. We need to give it time to work out. Then from about 2006 to 2009, you have Al Gore and the Inconvenient Truth. You have the IPCC's report. You have the Kyoto Protocol finally comes in, and then it all leads up to Copenhagen, and then it goes away with a damp squib, and everyone kind of retreats and licks their wounds. Then from about the end of 2018, you have Greta Thunberg, you have the IPCC's report that says 1.5 has got to be done in 12 years or all toast. I'm paraphrasing. You've got Extinction Rebellion. And, yeah, we're in the middle of another wave, and I suspect that by about 2021, people will have gotten bored of the story. People will have realized that it's hopeless and helpless. And I think your guest, Nat Hagen, is right. The number of changes that you would need to make to the transport system, to the energy system, to the food system are enormous, and these systems interlock. In academia, we talk about a nexus, so there's a water, energy, transport nexus, which means that within each individual system, you have inertia, you have pushback when you try to change things, you have vested interests, you have what we call path dependencies and sort of cognitive lock-in. Academics are very good at inventing new labels. that's their stock in trade. But what it ultimately adds up to is that we need not just a transition, we need a transformation. It has to be extremely rapid. And especially here in the United Kingdom, we have a real interest in accelerating socio-technical transitions, which sounds very grand. The question to always ask is, well, who's going to do it? Is it going to be the policymakers who've been doing it on status quo grounds for 30 years? Why would they suddenly wake up one morning and commit career suicide? Is it going to be the trades unions? Well, no, because they're invested in the current system. Is it going to be the politicians? Well, no, they're thinking about the next election. So who's it going to be then? And there's always a sort of a smudgy answer of, oh, well, civil society, or sometimes people will say social movements. But, you know, social movements get exhausted, they get co-opted, they get repressed, they get confused, or they're confused from the beginning. So, yeah, look, the prospects for meaningful change are extremely remote. I mean, I don't know if you saw this about me, I chose not to have children. In 2004, I'd been together for a year or two with the woman who's now my wife, and we had the discussion, and I had a vasectomy. Not because of what I thought my child would do to our precious, precious planet, but because of what the world would be like by the time my child, say born in 2005, would be like by the time it was my age, 30. I mean, I chose to have a vasectomy.
Right. And well, now, they say think globally, act locally. What is happening? You're doing that for sure. Well, what is happening with climate activism in Manchester?
There's an upsurge of people doing actions, which is apparently what activism is. Very quickly, 10 years ago, the city council, the city government made a set of promises on climate change. I know this because I was part of the people who forced them to do it and to make it quite radical. They spent 10 years not doing the things that they'd promised to do. We forced them to make a new set of promises. So it's kind of like Groundhog Day, but without Bill Murray learning anything, which is kind of a tragedy, not a comedy. And so last July, the City Council unanimously voted for a climate emergency declaration with 23 distinct promises of things that it would do. We knew that they weren't going to probably be keeping that many of those promises very quickly. So we'd already set up a group called Climate Emergency Manchester, and we do these reports every 3 months called Hung, Drawn, and Quarterly, where we submit Freedom of Information Act requests to the council about all the different elements of their climate action plan. And then we produce a written report that we put up online, and we say, well, here's the gap between your rhetoric and your reality. And the council are slightly less than happy about us doing that. But in terms of how much will change, it's the future, isn't it? We don't know for sure. We will keep pressing for real action, and if and when they start taking real action, we'll applaud them. But that's probably going to be a while.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mark Hudson. He's currently in Manchester, a transplanted Australian, and we're talking about the fires in Australia and a burning world. All right, now, from the understanding that I can't broadcast any swear words, from the activist standpoint, what do you expect at the COP26 in Scotland?
I expect some protesters will get physically damaged at those protests. I expect a lot will get psychologically damaged and burnt out. I think that Glasgow, which is the COP26, and it's happening from the 9th to the 20th of November, is going to be an enormous energy suck and opportunity for people to do performative burnout. I remember 5-6 years ago when people were mobilizing for Paris, and I certainly remember 10 years ago when they were and 11 years ago when Copenhagen, last chance to save the world, we've all got to go. And then when it was a failure, within a couple of months, all the momentum had drained from the climate movement, when you open a fist and you open your palm and the fist is gone. It just vanished almost overnight. So I am encouraging people to think differently about what their activism is focused on in 2020. I know that I'm going to fail, and I know that most people are going to think that Glasgow is the be-all and end-all. The meeting itself will produce the usual fireworks that these do. Depends on whether Trump is still president or not to some extent. The Australians will probably still be recalcitrant. The Saudis, the Europeans will bicker among themselves, but eventually produce a united front. The Chinese will do what the Chinese do, whatever that is. The developing world countries will beg for faster action as they sink beneath the waves. The activists will be there in their numbers, hoping, ironically, that Glasgow will be unseasonably warm in November, because it gets pretty cold up there. It's kind of like Labrador, I guess. And then by December or January, there will be a lot of disconsolate, physically and emotionally exhausted people, and it will be that much harder to get them to engage in local action. Now, that's quite a bleak view, and again, as I've said several times, I hope I'm wrong. I don't know why I would be wrong. I think this is a relatively safe bet on my part, and we within Climate Emergency Manchester, one of our goals for this year is to offer a safe haven for people who either choose not to go to Glasgow or who after Glasgow still want to do activism but can't face the sort of noisy, physically draining and threatening situations that big conferences like that produce.
Well, we've got to wrap this up, but Mark Hudson, here's the question that a lot of scientists talk to me about via email, but not so much publicly. And the question is, are we going to save ourselves or is it too late?
Kafka said, there's hope, but not for us. I think because we have failed to take action since 1988, because we've just kept making things worse by building new pipelines, new cars, new airports, by not helping the developing world contain population growth, though I don't want to say that poor people are to blame for this. Because of all those things, I think it's extremely unlikely that the current human civilization will persist for very much longer. If you pressed me, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, but I don't think we're going to tech out, and I don't think we're going to have the whole Star Trek sort of Federation gleaming cities and warp speed. That's off the table. I think it's going to be much closer to sort of the Mad Max dystopia. Again, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see any reason why I would be.
From the UK and Keele University, we've been speaking with Australian Dr. Mark Hudson. Find him at markhudson.net, and Mark is spelled with a C. My thanks to Australian author Guy Murphy for leading me to you, Mark, and thanks so much for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And, if anyone wants to get in contact with me, they can find me on Twitter at Mark, that's with MarkSrHudson, HudsoN. No trolls, please. I'll just mute you or block you.
Right you are. I'll put all that in my own blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.